Okay, so today we're here with James Charles. Thank you for meeting with us. My name is Jen Peeks, and my project partner is Alice Bailey. And we're in Bethel, Alaska on Friday, July 27, 2018. A little bit about myself. I moved here to Bethel in 2004 and worked as a social worker with the Lower Kuskokwim School District. Later, I started working at UAF Kuskokwim campus. I now work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group Coordinator and the Western Region Board Support Coordinator. And this is how I got to know you over the years. These interviews are part of a senior project for an undergraduate degree in fisheries at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. These interviews are not connected to Fish and Game or the department at all. Fish and Game has no influence on what we're doing or this interview. Alice Bailey is currently an assistant professor of photography at the University of Virginia, and she was the former working group coordinator before I was, so that's how she's gotten to know you. The purpose of this project is to document your knowledge and experiences with the Kuskokwim River salmon fishery and its management. We appreciate you sharing your stories. We have learned so much about the fishery from you, and we want future generations to hear what you have to say about the fishery. We won't ask you anything that we think is too personal for you. You can stop the interview at any time. These interviews will be archived at UAF, so anyone will be able to listen to them. And they may be available on the internet at some point. They're trying to put everything online for people. So share only what you feel comfortable sharing with people from the public. You don't have to answer any questions that you don't want to. We expect that this interview will take about an hour. Feel free to answer in whichever language you feel most comfortable speaking in. And participating in this project is voluntary. If at any time you want to stop or take a break, or you decide you don't want to participate anymore, that's okay. Just let us know. If you need a break or if you need some water, let us know and we can pause. We already went over the two consent forms that you signed for this project and for letting us archive it at UAF. And I think that's about it. Do you have any questions before we get started?
No, not at the moment, but I appreciate what you do to me and pick up for a few other people to help you, and I'm always available for anybody who needs help. When I can be helpful to people who need help.
Well, thank you, James.
You're welcome.
So let's get started. Can you tell us your full name in English and if you have a Yupik name?
My name is James Charles, James A. Charles. My middle initial is my Yupik name. It's long, but Ayagak is my Yupik name, but I use it for middle initial because years ago when there were the old people, even their brothers and sisters, they had different last names. Those years, they used their Yupik names in this region.
Does your Yupik name have a meaning?
It may mean something, but it's about Ayagayak is going. Something about going, going away, Ayagayak.
Okay. How do you spell that?
There's two different ways to spell it nowadays. But when the first missionaries came, we use like my driver's license, Ayagak, that's the way it used to be spelled.
Okay, AIAGIAK.
Yeah, but later on they changed K to Q.
Okay. Tell me about your family and your partner.
My family is, I was raised by my mom because my father, uncle, grandmother died within 1 year from tuberculosis years ago, and my mom raised me and two others, my younger brother and sister, and my sister and I am living now, but younger boy who was a boy, a man, was or died in battle years ago.
What was your mom's name?
Mom's name was Chung Aoyach in Yupik, but Emma Andrew, Emma Charles, and she got married again later on, so her last name was changed to Andrew.
Can you describe her? What was she like?
She was part Kasak, but she was born in a village and raised in a village, and she was a very good woman, I think, because she was hunting and fishing too, and learned me some things that because those years, fathers were a guy's teacher, but women learn from, or the girls learn from their moms. And my mom did everything like a man's tradition. She learned me a lot, and why she learned me was the food that's on the river that's available, and like the blackfish, stickleback is what I survived on too, because those years there was no welfare, no food stamps, nothing. But she would go out fishing and hunting and help me survive.
Where did you live when you
I
left?
lived at Ulkinak when I was a kid, but Kinak, river was getting bad, so we moved to Tundutulak, the main river over there. So Kinak is a very small village. That time the populations was down. As you know, the population grew everywhere, even in Bethel. And we would count people, but now I'm lost. I know Tundutulak was only 75, 75 people altogether. I was helping with the church later that back some candy for treat in Christmas time. And now I helped 2 years ago, and it was more than 400 people, from 75 to 400 something. So people moved back a little from the riverbanks. The riverbanks were where people lived, even in Bethel. Bethel, when it first selected the area, and Bethel was on the river, where it's easier to travel, I think, those years, because we traveled by kayak or rode a boat or no motors, no fast motors like we do now.
Who made your boats when you were young?
I had to do it myself because my father died when I was 9 years old, 8 or 9 or whatever that area, and I had to build my first boat myself, because I look at other people, how they do it, and my wooden boat was what I built myself.
How long did you use that boat?
It was for a few years anyway, but we did not have aluminum boats that time, but nowadays everybody's using aluminum boat and fast motors.
Do you remember when you saw the first aluminum boat or the first motor?
I don't remember what year it was, but I bought enough aluminum boats myself and used them for fishing, and because I used to go to Goodnose Bay for herring fishing and commercial fish a little bit over there in Bristol Bay, and commercial fish down the river, on the Cusson Cream River, when fish was commercial fishing available those years. There was enough fish on the river.
So when you were young, what sort of activities did you do when you were a child?
The activities we did was not much like today. We would play bat or what you call kaludak, that hockey or something like that. We did a lot of those when we were young. And in winter time, in summer time, you can get out and do the outside work. But when I was young, we play with the string and ahak like that, or compete with others that who can do the ahak a long time.
James, what year were you born, if you don't mind me asking?
1940.
Okay. Can you describe the area that you were raised in? What did it? What was the land like? And the like?
When I was a kid, I would go to Bethel if somebody take me to Bethel, but we were driving wooden boats those years, and when I was a kid, we traveled on foot or by boat or dog team in winter time. In the winter time, We used the dog teams, but I asked my mom if I can raise those dogs too. And she said, no, it's going to be embarrassing to hear me. My dogs died from starving because I'm so lazy. I listened to her, and so I didn't raise dogs. I had to walk my way around. One time I walked from Bethel to Tundutulak, and from Tundutulak to Guigilnuk, because there was no Ganginak those years. Guigilnuk was the closest downriver village, and Eek was another one. But I've walked to have a trap line on the line, I mean on a trap line, and found my wife at Guigilnuk. That's what the people were saying, that Senator Dan Sullivan wrote about me. Because that's a true story too, and I believe that, and because I've walked years ago in winter time, and I've heard people were walking around the Kilpak Mountains way over there, and they've walked over there and heard the reindeer years ago.
What was that like walking to Quig?
It was okay, but the government put the cabin in between villages too. Like there was a cabin between here and Tundutulak, and there was another cabin down below Tundutulak to Guigilnuk area, and that way the trail is marked too. With some of the trail markers are still up, the metal ones, and the cabins were built those years too, and I didn't stay in that cabin between Tundutulak and Guigilnuk. I had the sod house made by somebody and slept in there, and it took me a couple of days to go to Guigilnuk in the winter time. But I start early in the morning with the guy who was going to walk over to Guigilnuk area or trap line, and we start in the dark in the morning, and be home in the dark at night. We walk all day in winter time.
How old were you when you did
was
that?
15 or 15 when I first started trapping and with that guy.
And what sort of animals did you trap?
I've trapped mink, and mink was good fur that people pay more for the mink and foxes, and I've trapped for those years ago.
So when you'd start on your journey for your trap line, what sort of things did you bring with you?
Just pull a kayak sled or a backpack in there, and mainly tea was what we carried in there, and no food. Food we have is available in the cabins, and we hunt and fish for those. And when we go to that place, we have food in there, a little bit of food, but we don't fill our stomach until we can't eat anymore. We're now like nowadays, food is not available all the time.
When you were doing your trap line, was there any times that you felt nervous?
Yeah, because those years I would carry a gun, but like 22 is the light one, but we were scared of ghosts too, but I've never run into ghost anything like that, but I don't, that's why I warned my little boy when he watched the TV and watching the ghost story, like he likes that, but I tell him that there's no ghost available, or there's no ghost. I tell them those are made up stories.
Did your mom give you any advice before you'd go on the trap line?
Oh, yeah. She did a lot. She talked to me a lot. And what she, what I learned from her was, I'm not the only person in the world. There are people upriver, there are people on my side, there are people behind me too. And if I look, if I'm on the river, think of people that's above me, on the sides and on behind. And I learned a lot from her, and you can pick up other advises too from other people too, and that's the way we were told to follow years ago, and just do whatever you are. Even if somebody don't direct to me, talking to their kids and stuff like that, and pick it up and it will help.
So your mom taught you a lot. Was there anybody else in your early days that you remember teaching you things?
Oh yeah, I do. With my kids, I still do teach my kids and how to live and survive. Like my mom, she used to tell me what to eat and what not to eat, and like the poison stuff in the wilderness. And she told me I can survive eating mouse food. Mouse food is the easy one that you dig and find them. But there are others that's on the ground that's not good for the health.
It sounds like your mom taught you a lot.
Yes, she taught me a lot, and what she told me one time was eating those, what even I didn't like them. The taste is what I don't like, but if I swallow it, I wouldn't know what I eat before. That's what she told me years ago, but she was my teacher. And if I don't pick up others telling their kids too.
Was there a school around when you were young?
When I was young, there was a school in my at ter territorial times before BIE came around and taught school. But after we moved to Tundertulak, we moved over there when I was 8 years old, from Kinnock to Tundertulak, and there was a territorial school went down, and in a little old house, we go to school in the morning, other group go to school in the afternoon, and my school teacher at that time, still alive, she's 102 years old and lives in Anchorage now, but she was my teacher, and she would speak in Yupik just like me, but she didn't allow us to speak our language in the class, so we had pretty quiet school. So we write, I learned to write my name the first year, and then we would be doing the what she taught us.
Did you like school?
Yeah, I like school, but I had to get out of that school because I was already 15. I was getting old already, for 5 years of school, I was fourth grader, but didn't even finish the fifth grade. But I finished fourth grade, so that's all the education I have. But I decided to take the GED course later, and I got GED course and passed it, and I got high school diploma from fourth grade to high school. Anyway, I'm a pilot now too, and pilot's license is lifetime. I've just found that out. All I need is medical exam and go see the doctor and see if I can be flying. So I flew a little bit for 42 years anyway, and had 6 different airplanes. I've landed on Dal Lake. You see the Dal Lake, pretty small, but that was big lake when we were young, because there was no graveyard on the west side, no buildings around it, and my first airplane was cheaper than $5,000 for a four-seater, and I've been buying four-seater planes all the time though. 182s and 172s, and that's what I like, but prices gone up more and more all the time. So I bought my last airplane from Renton, Washington.
What made you decide to get your pilot's license?
I went to training in Anchorage for a couple of weeks because I was a maintenance man at the old BIE school, and I didn't have all the time I wanted to learn to fly outside, but all I had was available 2 weeks of leave, and I left. I asked my mom, see if I can learn to fly. She said, you're gonna die kill yourself in a plane crash because people, if they were not careful or the inspections before they take off, and they were killing themselves those years. But I learned to fly years ago. I was off from my work and for 2 weeks, and went to Anchorage, learned to fly, and next year I got my I went over there again and bought a plane, learned the rest myself, and as my buddy was telling me, Billy McCann, he said, "As long as you can start the engine on the airplane, you can take off and land." Because the first airplane pilot did not have instructor, and he's right. And so I learned to fly in Anchorage, but I've pushed my the people who are going to learn that they picked a good school. Like my grandkid, he's a pilot for Grand Aviation now, and so is my one of my nephews, Johnny Andrew Jr. from Guilin. He's a pilot too.
Once you got your pilot's license, what'd your mom say?
My mom didn't want me to learn to fly, so I had to ask her a few times to learn to fly. And she said no at the first time I asked her. And I wait for 1 year, I think, and ask her again, see if I can learn to fly. No, she said no. But the third time I asked her, she said, "You can try, but be careful, don't fly too much." So I didn't like the commercial pilots those years. I wanted to fly and go to the areas where the game is available, like hunting and fishing with those airplanes. And that's why I got the camp at Kilbuck Mountains. I've landed and picked a lot over there, and that was my grandma found out later on, that was my grandmother's lot. So I applied for it and got it as what you call it, allotment, land allotment.
Were there other people from this area that were pilots back then?
Yeah, there was natives. I didn't know they were all. Jimmy Samuelson was flying, and so is old man Harry Faulkner, and Juice Allison, Ray Chris. They were pilots too those years, and I wanted to follow them, and that's why I learned to fly. I had to listen to my mom and ask her three times to get my license, and she was really glad when I got my license. 2 years after I'd been to flight school, I got my license over there in Anchorage when John King was giving out training.
Did your mom fly with you?
Yeah, my mom flew with me, and I told her that she's the one that makes my airplanes broke down in the air. Because I one time I brought her back from Tugayaq, and my alternator went out that time, but the engine was kept going. And another time I took her to church at Eek, and flying the short area there, halfway in between, my cylinder went out. So I broke the cylinder and chopped the power and glide over there and land on the runway at Eek. But I tell her that she's the reason that my airplanes break. If I carry her, if I have other passengers, the airplane is okay. But every time I take her out someplace, she's the one that makes my airplane break because she didn't want me to learn to fly.
Do you have a trip that stands out for you, a trip that you remember?
I've been to a lot of areas, like in Alaska. I've been to Nome, I've been to Kotzebue, I've been to Point Barrow, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and I never go southeast anyway, because when I fly to Anchorage, that's the end. And I've been to Bristleby a lot, flying over there, fly myself over there and land on sand strips, no gravel, nothing that time, but we were flying to the dirt runways, not like today. Even Tundutulak had a dirt runway years ago on the riverbank.
And James, you told me one time about the runway in Tundutulak that you helped build that runway.
Yeah, that was a runway made by hand years ago. We cut the willows with axes and leveled the ground with hand shovels and stomped the ground. And there was our runway. And and some villages were, or they copied us and they made runways by hand. No machinery. Nothing. Okay.
So James, I want to go back to your family. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that you met your wife in Quigg. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yeah, she's I'm still married to her, and she's really nice woman, like my mom. She's part white and part Yupik, and she grew up in a village too, and she has the education, more education than me, but she don't speak English either. But she, when people are raised in villages, they spoke Yupik all the time, or not Yupik all the time, but some areas are, Inupiaq has their own language, and the Indians from Southeast have their own language too. So That's the way she, my wife, was raised in a family that spoke Yupik. So she's always think of tradition that she grew up with.
And what's her name?
Her name is Nancy Charles. She used to be Nancy David, but since we married and she changed her last name.
And do you have children?
Yeah, we have five kids. Three of our own kids were Rosemary. She's still the girl. She's still away from us. Anyway, she went to high school and she lives in Sitka now, and she works at a native hospital over there. And so our boy was got married to a girl at Nunavichak, and he passed away. We have another kid of our own, Jesse Charles, named after my late brother. Anyway, those were our own kids, but we adopted two more boys. Fritz is another one. He's the working group chairman, one of the chairmen, and Dennis is another kid that we are raising, and he's 15 now, and I'm 78 now. And raising kid like that helps me, because I make me feel young again.
So, James, tell me about fishing in your area. How do people fish by you?
Fishing was not easy. When I was a kid, we had to make our own nets. Those years, we did not have a king salmon net. And if people are going to fish camp, they go to fish camp when we were very poor. If we don't want to paddle our what do you call it, row the boat to fish camp, we stay in spring camps. And a lot of times we did not have boats of our own. And those years, spring camping was traditional those years, because we are feeding on some lake salmon or lake fish, not salmon, but fish like pikes and lush or others. Sea fish, and we survived on those because fishing was a lot of work. And those years we did not have nets to buy from the stores, or we make our own nets, weave the net, and like 10 to 15 feet long, maybe 5 or 6 meters deep. And that's a net we used to catch fish. But we fished We were fishing with Taluyaks years ago, the fish trap. We make the big one for catching bigger fish, and for black fish we make our own nets or Taluyak, then not the net but Taluyak for those. And so fishing was always up and down. I just found out later that we were not catching very good, catching salmon very good at Tundurtulak, so people moved to Johnson River fish camp, move where the river is narrower and catch the salmon is easier. And so people do that now, and Johnson River Fish Camp is still going.
How did you make those traps?
The traps were, we find a driftwood and split it and make taluyaks out of those. And for big fish, big trap is big fish, and we had to fence the river.
And what materials did you use for the nets back then?
For net, we weave our own nets with the twine. The twine we buy $8 or $10 or something like that. Now it was only 50 cents, and we trade it with some like muskrat pelt or mink trap or fox from the trading posts for the stores. If they have some garments or like the clothes, we trade it with the pelt. Because those years the garments were only the ones that we catch out there on, like on the tundra or mink or snowshoe rabbit or Arctic hare and foxes and stuff like that were our garments.
So when you used the nets, you didn't have motors back then.
No.
So did you usually do set nets or drift nets or?
Set nets mostly. Most of the time is set nets, and when I was young, we drifted to learn to drift and rowed a boat, not keeping the net straight, or try to keep the net straight, because we rowed the boat, and rowing all night because we don't see the people drifting in daytime. They're always all night or night people, and in the morning they bring the fish to the fish camps, and women worked on it. And women those years, and nowadays it's men too. I work on my catches.
Was there management back then when you were young? Do you remember any form of management happening?
No. When I was young, I never heard of management those years. whatever is available, it was available for us, like in summer, winter, spring, fall. There was no management, nobody tell us when we supposed to go out fishing or not fish or close the fishery.
Do you remember elders telling you about how to fish or what, how to use the fish?
Yeah, we cooked the fish in boiled containers or boiling all the time. Water or wood, put the wood in there and mainly no pans those years. No frying pan or something like that. It's always kettle, boiling kettle, boiled water, boiled fish and meat, and everything we eat was boiled.
Did you preserve the fish in any other ways?
We preserved the fish by drying or burying under the ground or where there's permafrost. We bury the fish or dry them. Nowadays we have freezers, and those years it was hard because people would be digging the ground, and where the permafrost is keeping the food fresh, or not really fresh, but available when we need it.
Do you remember when commercial fishing started?
Yeah, in 60s or 50s. Late 50s and early 60s, when I went to cannery in 1957, I was in the cannery, and I heard there was commercial fishing on the river for kings only. Those years it was kings that they sold for 65 cents for a small one, $2 for a medium size, and large was, the larger ones were $2 a fish. And as they got smaller, the small one was only 65 cents when I first commercial fished.
What was that like when commercial fishing first started in the area? What did people think about it?
Those years, the processors were giving away nets, and we didn't have to weave our own nets too. Those years, and weaving our own net, we make messes whatever we decide. It was mostly 5.5 or something like fingers.
And so they gave you nets. Were people still using boats with no motors, or?
They started using motors those years. And commercial fishing was started, and they start giving away nets, and but when I was a kid, I didn't see those nets available, in stores and in the commercial fishing companies. We make our own nets, and Like I told you before, the messes were small, but 5 or 6 messes deep, and 10 to 15 feet long. It's a long net.
Did you commercial fish?
Yeah, I commercial fished, and I bought some salmon too. I started commercial fishing because my late brother was commercial fishing, and he was using a wooden boat. Those years, wooden boats were the only ones we had around here. No aluminum, nothing. And aluminum boats, nothing. Anyway, I started making my own boat with planks, the net, I mean the plywood, no plywood either those years. Anyway, the planks were the 1 by 1 by 6 or something like that, and we made boats with those, and when I commercial fish, we were rowing the boat like I told you earlier, we're rowing the boat all night, and commercial fishing was run by fish and game people. When they opened it was open all week.
So that's changed a bit.
Yeah, that changed a bit now, and we are involved as a working group members.
The Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group was created in 1988. Can you tell me about how you got involved with that group?
Yeah, why I was selected to go talk to Fish and Game and Fish and Wildlife Service was because I spoke a little bit English, and these other elders, they didn't speak very good English, but they could have translators, I spoke a little bit English, and why those Philip Charlie, Nick Lupi, and those other elders from my village selected me to go to Fish and Game and talk to them a little bit, and I wasn't speaking. I've never have spoke plain English, but we speak Yupik language at home all the time. Anyway, why I was chosen to go to those meetings were because of those elders who thought I should go and join the group. And I've been with the group ever since that time, and I always blame Dr. John White that he started me on the mess. But that's okay, but that helps because I call in a talk show once in a while and tell the people that in the region, in a radio station, that the area is closed or open for fishing. And when I'm home, I use marine radios to translate and let the people know. The area is closed and open.
What was management like during that time?
I've worked with Ray Baxter those years, and a lot of people talk about him because Ray Baxter was the biologist over here in Bethel, and he would open the. He didn't have the working group members, but he would open the river for commercial fishing and close it when it's closed. But subsistence fishing was available anytime those years.
What were some of the things that in the early days of the working group, what were some of the discussions you'd have? What did you talk about?
We've discussed and closed the areas and like the when we talk about Kuskokwim, we opened it from the line out there at the mouth to headwaters or wherever. I did not know the headwaters too, McGrath or Nikolai or places like that. But I learned from my mom years ago, I'm not the only person on the river. I have to think of people up there and on the sides and behind me.
What was it like meeting with a group that had people from all over the river?
Those years we did not have very good communications, but we tell the people that who can go home and pass it on to their kids and family and but we did not have very good communications those years. But we learn from somebody seeing this and that, and that's open and closed. But when Ray Baxter opened the river, it's open to commercial fishing, and he didn't talk about subsistence fishing and hunting either. But when it's open, we know that it's open for people in the region.
Were there any challenges with the working group?
It is getting now complicated, but even using calendars, we now use what's open, what area is open, what area is closed, and so on. But even I see complications nowadays. It's complicated, but some people may be wrong in the area too. Where it's open and where it's closed, but we are now lucky. We have better communication than we were when we were young. Anyway, those years when the word is passed on, it's passed on to families and brothers and sisters and. But now we have marine radios and we have KYUK and it's easier now than it used to be.
What are some of the changes in fishing nowadays? What is fishing like nowadays?
Fishing is little bit harder nowadays, but those years we did not have like the stores in the villages to back up the food, like we if we don't have frozen fish or frozen or dried fish, we did not have backup those years, but now we have some available, like chicken or meat or beef or anything in the stores. It's easier now than it used to be, but somebody have to have money to buy those.
Do you, what, can you describe what your role is on the working group? What do you do on the working group? What's your role or what seat are you in on the working group?
I have been a working group member all the time, but I'm with the Regional Advisory Council too, and I have a lot of, my hands are full. I'm a working group member, RAC member, and fish commissioner, and I am with the Fish and Game Advisory Committee, and so I do a lot of work, but I chair the working group members too now.
What keeps you involved with all these groups?
Because I told you earlier that the elders in my village, now I'm not afraid to speak whatever I can speak to the Department of Fish and Game or the Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm not shy anymore. It is easier now than it used to be, because those years I didn't speak very good to anybody, but now if I if somebody don't like me, they don't have to kill me, but I'm trying to help everybody, because it is good work now, that I understand, working with the Department of Fish and Game, working with Fish and Wildlife Service, and with the people, and working with the people, and working for the people too. That way, I'm easier now than it used to be, because I can talk to the people and tell what's going on, why we shut the fishery down or other games too.
Can you tell me what that's like, having to tell people back at home that they can't fish or they can fish? How do people respond to those messages?
Some people still don't like the way we do for them, but why we close the river for fishing is because they can have fish available when they need them later on. It's not like closing it for because we didn't like the people, but we like everybody. We want everybody to have them who needs available, white people, black people, or natives, like us who wants a resource.
Being on the working group with so many different users and people mm-hmm. from different areas, have you learned anything from...
Yeah, I learned a lot that everybody's same now. They want food available for them because food is what keeps us going. And if we don't have food available, we'd be starving. And but like I told you, the stores have backup now. They are backup now, available at the stores, and even homeless people are they've reached by families years ago, and now they want to use their own mind and be homeless, and it's themselves. But if we use our mind clear and sound, it is we would survive our own.
You work a lot with youth. Like this week, you're actually working mm-hmm. with a bunch of youth. What do you share with them?
The youth we now have are they have some have very good they'll be they'll have money available to buy to go to stores or buy their own nets and boat or whatever they need to survive. They are not like us when we were young, and they can go get stuff if they have to, and they're totally different as when we were raised.
What do you hope for the future generations?
Future is for future generations. I'd like to keep what we have now available, and for the people and for us too, elders. Elders are can be helpful to their younger people.
Do you have any thoughts on how management can improve?
Not really. Management is what we what we know now. We've learned from the past how the fishery is closed and opened and closed, and because the management want everybody who needs a resource to have it available.
Well, James, I really appreciate you talking with us today. Is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
Not really, but I've talked enough. But I, like I said, I'm not very educated, and so my speaking may be broken. But I do the best I can, and like the management tool is what I always support management on the river and for other resource too, like the game, because we can have what's available later on if we open it again for people to have the resource.
Do you think you'll stay on these committees for a while?
I hope so.
Well, James, again, Alice and I really appreciate you meeting with us and visiting with us and sharing your history and your experiences.
Thank you. I do the best I can, but I may not have the answers for some of your questions, but I do the best I can. I'm not very educated, like I told you, but I learn a lot. Every day I learn something.
Well, and we've learned a lot from you.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, James.